And the main difference is, what's the average income? What's the average GDP per capita? And to be a developed market, that number needs to be over 25,000. So if you're below 25,000 of average income, you're an emerging market. And if you're really low down, you're a frontier market, which is like the farm team for emerging.
This is Dana Samuelson with the American Gold Exchange. You're listening to the Average Joe Finances Podcast with Mike Cavagione.
Welcome to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. Are you trying to get out of debt? Invest, or just not sure where to start? Then this is the place for you. We discuss different ways to get out of the rat race and build your wealth. Join us on this wild ride to financial freedom.
Hey, welcome back to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cavagione, and today's guest is Kevin Carter. So Kevin, we were talking a little bit before I hit the record button, has some really exciting stuff to share with us, and I am super stoked to have him on the show today. So Kevin, thank you so much for joining me.
Sure, Mike. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. It's always great to be here. Now I'm in Hawaii. Where are you at again?
I'm in San Francisco, where it's raining.
Raining and probably a little chilly right now,
Not Hawaii.
All right. Now we've had some rain lately too, so nothing too crazy. But Kevin, I want to kick things off the way I start every podcast episode, and we'd like to know more about you. So if you could share a little bit about yourself, tell us your story. Like, who is Kevin Carter?
Sure. Let me start with, my name is Kevin Carter, as you said, and I live in San Francisco, or actually I live 15 miles east of San Francisco. And I've lived here pretty much my whole life, except for a few years off at college. And when I graduated in January of 1992, I showed up back here in San Francisco, and I didn't totally know what I wanted to do, but I managed to get an interview with what was the leading investment bank on the West Coast back then, Roberts and Stevens and Company, which was really the leading investment bank for technology companies through the 80s and 90s. And I had one interview, and we talked about college basketball for 20 minutes, and then I got a 2-minute overview of the investment business, and they said, you can start Monday. And I immediately said, I don't know how I could start Monday. I don't really know anything about the stock market or investing. And they told me to go buy a book called A Random Walk Down Wall Street, which I brought a copy of to show you and suggest people be interested in this book. But I bought the book and I read it over the weekend. And the book, it's pretty well known in the institutional part of the investment world. It was first written 50 years ago by a man named Burt Malkiel, who's a Princeton economist and also was the dean of the Yale Business School and the chairman of the Princeton Economics Department 5 times and on the board of advisors to the economic advisors with Alan Greenspan for the Ford administration. So he's been around a long time. But when he first wrote this book, what makes the book most famous is that 50 years ago, there was no such thing as an index fund. And there certainly wasn't any. And what Dr. Malkiel did when he wrote that first book was he suggested very clearly, and he even said, author's suggestion, that somebody should make an index fund, a fund that owned all the stocks, didn't try to buy and sell, and charged a very low fee. And specifically, he suggested the New York Stock Exchange do it and that it would be a great service to the investment world. They did not do it, but a couple of years later, his friend John Bogle did do it. And this book is really the foundation of a lot of things that have become the biggest part of investing now: index funds and then ETFs. And ETFs, Burton was also involved with. In fact, he was the chairman of the committee that created the first ETF, the SPDR. So that book it's a great primer on investing. Again, I reread it multiple times in my career, and it's been updated. And I think there's even some crypto coverage in the most recent edition. And so anyway, that's how I started. But what I realized pretty quick was I'm not a passive index person by nature. I'm a Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger person. And I try to think about all business and investment decisions through that lens. But I ended up in 1998, I became disillusioned with the investment business, and in particular with the mutual fund business, the traditional active mutual fund business, which I was part of and made money from. But I could see that there was a lot of problems, and that ultimately the people that benefited from the mutual funds were the people that owned the mutual fund company, and that there were all sorts of fees and hidden fees and marketing fees and loans that advisors got paid. And I had this idea that I thought would help level the playing field, because ultimately in investing, it's pretty simple. You want to start early and you want to invest as much as you can. And you just want to buy and hold and buy and hold. And if you can do that every month, great. And the problem with doing that is most people, especially when they're starting out, you might be able to save $200 a month, $500 a month, maybe $1,000 a month. But if you wanted to invest in the stock market, it wasn't cheap. And it was, in fact, it was basically not possible, because first of all, to buy stocks back then, the lowest commission you could get was $29.99 from Charles Schwab. But you had to buy 100 shares to get that commission. And the average stock price was about $30 a share. So if you wanted to invest directly into stocks, you needed $3,000 to just invest in one. And if you wanted to buy a diversified portfolio, you needed $100,000 to get into the stock market. And so people were stuck going into mutual funds and paying 1%, 1.5%, 2%, even more when you look at some of the other tax issues. And that's a pretty big setback. If the market's going to go up 11% and you're getting 8%, that doesn't sound like a big difference in 1 year, but the miracle of compounding, that's a lot more money if you get the 11% versus 8%. And so
absolutely,
what I conceived of was that people would be a lot better off if they could buy $10 worth of Coca-Cola or $5 of Microsoft. And then, of course, you had stocks like Berkshire Hathaway, where 100 shares at $30,000 a share, nobody could really do that. And so I invented fractional share dollar-based brokerage and found the right lawyers and got a tech team together and filed a patent on the system by which we could do this. But I asked Bert Malkiel, the author that I mentioned earlier, to be on my advisory board, because I knew he had been a champion of the small investor. And I knew that what I had come up with, at least the goal, was to level the playing field, if you will. And he supported it absolutely and said, this is better for people and I'll be on your advisory board. We sold that business to E-Trade in the year 2000. And then I was feeling entrepreneurial. I was very afraid of starting a company. But I did it and worked out. And then I started another one. And that idea was also something that has gone mainstream now. But the idea was that, okay, now you can invest in the stock market with $100 or $10 or whatever, but what do you buy? And then you've got a million flavors of how to do it. Ultimately at one end, you have just buy the index, John Bogle, right? And Bert Malkiel and Vanguard. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have Warren Buffett, right? Buy great businesses. But if you really look at it, it's not really a line. It's more of a circle, because Warren Buffett actually is the biggest proponent of index funds and has said that all of his money when he's gone will go into index funds. So they're really a lot closer than you think. But either way, you say, okay, I'm going to invest $100 a month and I'm going to do the Warren Buffett thing. Great. But what if you don't want to do that? You don't think you know how to pick a stock or find a great business or whatever? Fine. Then you can index in that dollar-based way. But you didn't want to buy an index fund. So we invented what they call direct indexing. We called it active indexing. But the idea was that, especially if you had fractional shares, you could build your own custom S&P 500 company. Maybe not use all 500 stocks, but you could use 50 and get the same basic return and risk of the 500. You could customize it. Maybe you don't want to own alcohol, or you don't want to own other things that you just don't want to own. But then you could also, for taxable money, you could do loss harvesting. So if you own the General Motors and the auto sector had a tough time, you could sell your General Motors at a loss and buy Ford. And so your portfolio would have the same exposure, but you could beat the index after tax. So that was the second thing that we started, and we ended up selling it to a big...
Quick question on that, Kevin. So yeah, you're saying, like, with the direct indexing, so you build your direct index fund, right? But if something's not doing well, you could sell it off at a loss, right? Claim that on your taxes.
Yes.
But you're not selling the other shares, right? You're just selling that specific. Oh, wow.
That's
pretty powerful.
And it was a math trick, and it's worked. I mean, this was a theory. And again, people said you're crazy and No one wants to do that. And now Schwab and Vanguard offer this, right? So it's gone mainstream 20 years later. But the theory was you could beat the index after tax. And it's worked incredibly well. I haven't seen the track records now well over 20 years long. And at least at some point in the last 5 years, the average annual tax alpha was about 3%. That's a lot of money over a 20-year period. So it's worked incredibly well, and it's almost certainly one of the best track records on the planet for U.S. large cap equity after fees and after tax, all of which matters. But yeah, that's what it is. And again, you can buy this now. I think Vanguard calls it personal indexing, and Schwab has another name for it. But anyhow, those were the first two things we did. And I call that my investment Peace Corps. Was bleeding edge, but it wasn't as profitable for me as some of the more, there's a lot of companies that have launched these things in the last 5-10 years that have done incredibly well, but we were very early in. But it's intellectually fulfilling to see these things go mainstream. Yeah, that's what I did to start. And then I've been focused on emerging markets, and I have been for the last 20 years. And basically what happened was at the time we sold this direct indexing business, Active Index Advisors, which you can find this company at the website's activeindexing.com. It's still operating. But right about the time we sold the company, which was the end of 2004, Google went public. And Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google, is a Princeton alum and a friend of Burton's and from Princeton. And when they went public, they asked Burton to come down to Mountain View to the Google headquarters and give a talk to their employees about investing, right? This guy knows all about investing, and he can help you out and set you in the right direction. And so he flew out to San Francisco, and I had dinner with him. I wasn't invited to the event, but he went down there and talked. And then a few months later, I got a call from a guy at Google, and he said, "Hey, I heard about this active indexing, and I really want to invest with you." And I told him that was great, and I was glad he called, but that we didn't work with individual investors. We worked with financial advisors at Morgan Stanley and Deutsche Bank and places like that. And he said, "I don't want an advisor. I know what I want to invest in, and that person is just going to add another fee. Why don't I just invest directly with you?" I agreed to go down to Mountain View one day and meet with this guy. He was young. I was pretty young. I was probably 30, but he was like 25. And I sat down with him and explained what we did. And then he said, "Can I invest with you?" And I said, "I don't know. How much money do you have?" And he told me he had a lot. And I said, "Okay, yeah, you can invest with us."
That's pretty vague, but fitting for and, that particular situation.
Oh yeah, he was pretty early, and I remember. So he said to me, "How much money should I put into this active S&P 500 strategy?" That's what we call it. And I said, "Let's think about it. I'm not in the asset allocation business, but I know what a pie chart generally looks like for different age groups. And you're young, so you should be aggressive. But you're pretty rich, so maybe you should be conservative." And I said, "We'll figure out a specific number. We'll call you moderate. And maybe that's 20 or 25% in the S&P 500. And then he said, "What about the rest of my money?" And I said, "We don't do anything else." And he said, "How would you invest it?" I said, "I'd probably just buy a bunch of ETFs and get the lowest cost allocation to bonds and real estate and international or whatever." And then he said, "Okay, can you do that for me?" And I said, "Sure." So I ended up becoming an advisor to this guy. And by the way, when I asked him two questions at that first meeting, first I asked him if he wanted to leave out tobacco or alcohol. We didn't call it ESG back then. I think they called it SRI, socially responsible investing. But everyone has their own opinions about what that means. And so I asked him if he wanted to leave anything out. He said, "I never want to own Microsoft." So it was a great example of why it's hard to prepackage up values-based indexes, because not everyone has the same values. So only thing he cared about was he didn't like Microsoft. And then when I asked him what he wanted to do with his life, he said these two words together I had never heard before: artificial intelligence. And now he's pretty big in that space. So anyhow, I end up becoming an advisor to that guy. He starts introducing me to other people at Google. So in 2005, I start going down to Mountain View pretty much every week in the springtime. And at the same time, my partner, Burton, who again is a Princeton economist, he started going to China. China's economy was really starting to take off 20 years ago and was growing at over 10% a year. And two of his Princeton economist friends were Chinese. And around the year 2000, they had been offered a lot of money to return to China and teach economics in Beijing. And they were good friends with Burton, and they started to call Burton and say, Burton, please come to China and see this. You have to see what's happening here. And so I'm going back and forth to Mountain View. Burton starts going to China, and then he writes a white paper with these two guys about investing in China. And the people at Google called me and said, can Burton come give a presentation here about investing in China? And I said, okay. And that was about 20 years ago.
So Kevin, real quick, this at this point in time, that's you and Burton were already partnered up?
Yes, we had joined forces for the first business, the fractional share business. He was an advisor to that business. He was the chief investment officer for active index advisors. But so I start going to Mountain View, he starts going to China, and him and his two friends wrote a paper about investing in China. Google called me and said, hey, can Burton come talk about China? And I said, yep, he's here every quarter for a board meeting. And next time he's here, we'll drive down and he'll give a talk. And so that happened. I picked up Burton down by the San Francisco airport and we drove to Mountain View. He gave this talk. And when he was over, all of these people looked at me and said, we want to invest in China. Now, I had no idea, but literally from the moment that talk ended until today, I've been trying to figure out what on earth does that even mean to invest in China? How do you do it? And then, of course, or maybe not of course, but China is, it's categorized as an emerging market, and it's by far the biggest emerging market. So I got pulled into emerging markets 20 years ago, starting with China, and that's how I got here. And it's been pretty fun, but again, it was completely random and unplanned on my part.
So Kevin, speaking of getting into emerging markets, can you tell me a little bit about what you do with that now, right? Because I know that's your bread and butter now, right? And this is what you've been doing now for the past 20 years, right? Since you started there. So what other like countries are you looking at? What other emerging markets are you looking at right now that are, you would say are hot?
Yeah. Okay. Let me first step back and try to make a real simple overview of what are emerging markets. What are these places? Obviously, the word emerging itself connotates some kind of growth. And
it generates excitement.
Yeah, there's some excitement. In fact, they used to call them third world countries, but when they created a mutual fund to invest in the countries, the mutual fund company decided nobody would invest in it if it was called a third world country fund. And so they changed the name to emerging markets. It was a marketing move in 1982. So anyhow, what are emerging markets? There's, if you look at the categories for the different countries of the world, you at the top, you have developed markets, the United States, Europe, Japan, Australia. Those are essentially the developed markets. Below that are emerging markets. And the main difference is what's the average income? What's the average GDP per capita? And to be a developed market, that number needs to be over 25,000. So if you're below 25,000 of average income, you're an emerging market. And if you're really low down, you're a frontier market, which is like the farm team for emerging. So developed, emerging, frontier. And so there's basically about 25 emerging markets. And the reason that people care about these countries is pretty straightforward. This is where most of the people on the planet live. About 6.5 billion people, 85% of the world's population. So they're bigger, they're younger, they have much better demographics. If you looked at the people under the age of 30, they're about 90% of the world. Their economies are growing faster. So these are economies that are industrializing, they're building infrastructure, and then ultimately they become a consumer country. So that's the evolution, right? You start with agriculture, you industrialize and manufacture, and ultimately you get to consumption. The reason you want emerging markets, they're big, they're young, they're fast growing. And the most important thing is that as they grow, as their economies grow, as the people's income grows, they want stuff. They want all the stuff we have. They want more and better food. They want more protein. They want more and better clothing. They would like to have a heater or a dishwasher or an air conditioner. They want a vehicle of some sort. They want to go on vacations and go to movies. And they want their children to go to college. And that's the story. Ultimately, when you really take apart this whole thing, 6.5 billion people are becoming consumers. And this is something that McKinsey calls the biggest growth story in the history of capitalism. That's a pretty hyperbolic statement. And maybe they're wrong, but if you're going to invest in emerging markets, that's what you want to focus on. And so where are those 6.5 billion people? The simplest way to look at it is one third of this is China. You've got 1.35 billion people in China. The other third is India. Now, India is a little bigger than China, so we'll talk about that. But India is now the biggest emerging market. So one third China, one third India. And then the other 24 or so countries, they're a third. And the biggest is Indonesia, Brazil, Turkey. And then if you get into the frontier markets, which we include, it's places like Nigeria. But it's basically Southeast Asia is most of this. Asia is 60% plus of the story. South America is about 15%. And then there's a whole bunch of countries that are scattered around South Africa, Egypt, Poland, Kazakhstan. And then there's a whole bunch of countries, especially in Africa, that don't even have markets. They're not even included. But so that's where they are. And again, it's heavy on Asia, Latin America as well. And then the rest is a hodgepodge. And it used to include Russia, for example, which perhaps highlights one of the risks in emerging markets.
Right. So actually, speaking of that, that brings up, makes me think of a great question for you. So if you're in a situation like that, so you're investing in an emerging market in Russia, and then what happens? What happens to your investment?
It went to zero. We had about 3%. Now, again, we invest in the internet companies. So we invest in right. the Amazon, not Amazon.com, but the Amazon.com of Brazil, or the LinkedIn of Russia was one of our holdings. So we had a few Russian holdings. And obviously, there's a horrible amount of tragedy in that whole situation. But one of the other things that happened was these very entrepreneurial internet companies with entrepreneurial founders had built some amazing businesses and very profitable internet platforms in Russia. And all of them got essentially just marked to zero because they were put on the blacklist. And so we actually technically in our portfolio, we own all of these stocks, but they just show up as a zero value. Now, for what it's worth, those same stocks are, some of them are trading in Moscow and have value. So it's possible that if somehow the situation resolves itself, probably in a way that involves a leadership change, perhaps they'll come back and they'll be worth something. But anyhow, we lost 3% on that. It was actually a pretty complicated day in the world of indexing because a lot of people, you know, not many people, nobody I heard of predicted that this was going to happen. It's because that, Russia
that's
was
not really something you can predict. You can sit here and watch certainly trends in the market and kind of figure out where it's going. But when it comes to whether or not a country is going to declare war or something like that, yeah, it's that's a tough call.
Yeah. So anyhow, but again, back to your big question. This is where all the people are and they want all the things we have, right? More and better food. You know, we've been in consumption here for generations now in some families. And my brothers and I were the first ones to go to college. But when I was a kid, we had cars. We went to Hawaii for vacation and things like that. But most of the world's just getting started. And that's going to go on for a long time. And that really is, I think, what you want to focus on in emerging markets.
We'll get back to the show after a brief break.
Attention fellow real estate investors, I know you're tired of ineffective marketing strategies that leave your lead generation feeling like a bust. Well, I've got a great solution for you. I've teamed up with Ballpoint Marketing to bring you a fresh approach to growing your business. With their handwritten direct mail marketing, your business will stand out from the crowd. Their amazing writing machines will craft personalized messages for each of your potential clients, making a lasting impression and increasing the likelihood of them responding to your message. They even make pen smudge marks to add to the authenticity. And for those of you that are driving for dollars, one of their most popular offers are handwritten door hangers. Placed directly on the front door, these door hangers show a potential seller how serious you are. With Ballpoint Marketing, you can trust their marketing strategy will be both effective and unique, just like your real estate business. Use my coupon code ABGJOE for an exclusive discount. Don't miss out on this opportunity to grow your real estate business and generate leads. Click the link in my bio for more. Real estate investors know they're leaving money on the table every time they pass a rundown property and do nothing about it. Deal Machine lets you and your team pin distressed properties, look up the property owner on the spot, and send a personalized postcard to the owner directly from the app, all within a few seconds. You can set up mail on repeat to make sure you won't forget to follow up, and while the app is sending a custom postcard, you can look up the owner's phone number and email instantly. Plus, if you want to find even more off-market deals, you can build a team of people to drive for you. You just get to track how many properties your deal finders add every day, making your deal finding a scalable and profitable process. Go to dealmachine.com and use the code AVERAGEJOE, that's AVGJOE, for 15 marketing credits during your free trial. That's AVERAGEJOE, AVGJOE. Let's get back to today's episode.
Right, right on. Okay, Kevin, so I have a big question for you then, right? Because besides emerging markets, just everything in general when you got started, what made you, when you graduated high school, decide you want to go to college and then get into the stock market in general? So I guess the question I'm asking you is, what is your why? Why are you doing what you do?
To be frank with you, when I got to the second half of my senior year of high school, I thought I was going to try to be in the special forces, because it sounded fun, and I wasn't a good student, and I was a free-range child, and I didn't have a lot of guidance and push towards going to college. And when the springtime came and all my friends were announcing, I'm going to UCLA, or I'm going here, I was flat-footed. And fortunately, one of my friend's fathers, who was a teacher and coach, he took me under his wing and helped me getting into college. So I can't say that I had any specific why at that point, other than being a 17 and a half year old kid. But when I graduated, even then, I'd always been pretty entrepreneurial and worked. And from the time I was a little kid, paper routes and dishwasher jobs, whatever. And I just, again, quite randomly, my uncle said, go talk to this guy. And I showed up and talked about, as I said, basketball for 20 minutes. And the guy said, buy this book. And then I read it. And I just became fascinated with the stock market. And I wanted to figure it out and understand it. And once I got out of college, I was a great student because then it mattered. And I read everything I could find. And I read it over and over again. And then I think ultimately the thing that maybe Bert and I have in common is we're just trying to make things better. We can see that there's parts of the system that could be more optimal for the average Joe investor, and not so much with trying to get rich. Wall Street's, I think most people show up on Wall Street and their motivation is to make a lot of money. And I'm not against that, but I was, I think, probably just more idealistic in wanting to fix these, what I thought were serious problems, and make some things that would make the end result for investors better. And then, as I said, I had traveled pretty extensively around the world, but I had never had any interest in China before. And I had never been there when Burton gave his talk. And the why to that part of my career was it was interesting. And I could see problems right away with the way it was done, which is, I guess, when I tell people the two things they need to know about investing in emerging markets, I learned both of them on the first day, right? For 20 years, I've been basically pursuing the two things that I think matter the most. And the first, the positive thing is that it is the emerging market consumer that you want to tap into. That's that consumption story. But what I saw was that the traditional indexes, the traditional ETFs to invest in China and other emerging markets, they were terrible. And I learned this in the first 5 minutes. After Burton's talk, we drove back to San Francisco that afternoon. And as soon as we got to the office, I went over to our portfolio managers and I said, the Google guys want to invest in China. And then I said, give me a list of all the companies in the China ETF, because there was only one China ETF on the planet back then. It has the ticker symbol FXI, and it's the iShares China ETF that was the first and only one available. And I assumed for these Google people, that's what we would use. We'd just give them a 5% allocation or whatever they wanted to China. But since I'm an Omaha person, I don't really care what the name of the fund is. I want to see what are the businesses we're going to own. And so I asked for the list of companies. And before they gave me the list, Burton pulled me aside and he said, Kevin, when you get the list, you're going to see that most of the stocks in the China ETF are Chinese government-owned banks and oil companies. Now, that didn't sound very good for a number of reasons. I've been to the Department of Motor Vehicles, for example, here, and I know how some of these state-owned things operate. And
oh, yes.
And then he gave me this example, and he basically told me that the Chinese banks make loans to bankrupt companies so they don't lay off employees. And that made me nauseous, because in Omaha, investing is really simple. The reason any business has value is because it makes profits for the owners. The only way to grow the value is to grow the profits for the owners. And you're telling me that these companies don't care about that. They don't. Nobody at the Agricultural Bank of China or Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, they don't show up on Monday morning with that goal. In fact, they're much more likely to have a plan of how they're going to steal money for themselves. And so when I got the China portfolio, the list of companies in the China ETF, it was 80% state-owned enterprises, right? So 80% of it's not trying, and it was about 8% in consumer stocks. So before I even sat in my seat, I'm looking at this, I'm like, okay, probably the worst thing to invest in is 80% of this, and the best thing you want is only 8%. And if you look now, if you go back, say, 15 years, and you look at the Chinese economy has grown 400%. If you bought the FXI, the China ETF from iShares, you lost 50% of your money so far. So you can say, okay, there's going to be all this growth, but then the stocks, the businesses in the index, they're not growing with that. And so that's ultimately the biggest problem in emerging markets, the big emerging markets index. If you buy the iShares or the Vanguard, the sort of vanilla emerging markets ETFs, your return is almost nothing. And people, and what happened?
Yeah, I want to add something in there too, because I do have some in I, right? And it's, I think I'm only putting 5% in right now. So
IEMG or EEM?
What is, I have to look again, because I do it through my first savings plan.
Okay.
Because I'm a federal employee too.
But it's an emerging markets offering inside of your, those are going to be pretty, almost certainly will be a vanilla. And this is the problem with, one of the things that I think makes me valuable in this indexing space is I ask questions. And it's not clear that a lot of people ask questions in this indexing world. And you have these, if you think about how this happens, you have an index company like S&P, MSCI, or FTSE. Now, for the U.S. benchmark, the S&P 500 is the main benchmark. But for emerging markets, it's the MSCI. And so you have this one company that makes a list. These are all the stocks in emerging markets. And then they just email the list over to some index portfolio managers. And there doesn't seem to be much questioning about, should this be what we own? And more importantly, the best companies are missing from the index. And this is something I also learned on the very first day. And because when I got that list of all the Chinese holdings, I got the warning about the banks and oil companies. And I, sure enough, I went down the list and there's all the banks and all the oil companies, a tennis shoe company and a snack food company, but not much consumer stocks. But at the bottom, I got to the bottom and I didn't see Baidu. Now, most of your listeners may not know what Baidu is. Baidu is the Google of China. And it actually went public before Google did. And it was basically the only Chinese company that I knew about, other than the beer company, Tsingtao. And so I was surprised it wasn't in the China ETF. And we called the iShares people and said, "Hey, we're thinking of putting some money into your China fund, but where's Baidu?" And they said, "We don't own Baidu." And I said, "I know. Why don't you own Baidu?" They said, "We don't consider it a Chinese company." And I said, "What do you mean? It's the Google of China." And a 25-year-old kid from Google just gave me $100 million. So it seems like it's good to be the Google of something, and maybe even really good to be the Google of the biggest country on the planet. And they said, "We don't own it because it trades in the United States on the NASDAQ." And I thought, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And so what this other big problem with the index is, the most entrepreneurial companies are the internet companies. They're founded by Harvard and Stanford grads that came from Brazil or India or wherever. They go to work for Google or Microsoft after they get their degree at one of our best schools. They get their MBAs at one of our best schools. And then they go back to their own country and they start an internet company. And they get funded by the best investors in the United States. And so when these companies want to go public, of course, they're going to go on the best exchanges, which are the NYSE and the NASDAQ. And because of that, they've been left out of the index. And so this was the, how about adding insult to injury? So this is not, this problem has not been fixed. They fixed a little bit of it. One of our favorite companies and most important companies in our business is a company called Mercado Libre, which trades on the NASDAQ with the ticker MELI. Some of your listeners may know this. This is the Amazon.com of Brazil. And it literally dominates all of Latin America. It's Brazil first, Mexico second, but every country, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, I mean, this is all about Mercado Libre. And Mercado Libre has also become the bank and the financial service provider there. So they sell mutual funds and ETFs to people as well. So imagine if Amazon.com is where you bought your stocks and had your checking account. That's actually happening. This is true. I mean, in Latin America, Mercado Libre, Mercado Pago, which is their payments platform, is now bigger than the original commerce business. Because what's happened in some of these markets is that Mercado Libre introduced e-commerce 20 years ago, but people were paying the drivers with cash. Nobody had a credit card or a digital payments form. And they thought, this is pretty clunky. Let's make our own digital payments platform just to facilitate their business. And they get the money on the phone, their payments app, and then they're like, let's sell them insurance. Let's become the bank. This has happened. So this Mercado Libre is like Amazon meets your bank and Vanguard. It's all of these things. But it's not in the index. The single greatest company in Latin America is not in the emerging market ETF that you own, almost for sure. It's not in any index. And in fact, there's 17 internet companies in Latin America that are public, most of them in the United States, and only one of them's in the index. And if you look at what's in the index from Latin America, these are your top three holdings. Vale, the Brazilian mining company that's had two catastrophic dam failures, still controlled by the government. In fact, I was just reading this morning that the Brazil's president is pushing for one of his cronies to become the new CEO of the mining company. And then the second and third largest holdings are both Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, which this is the poster child for the problems in these SOEs. And essentially, for a decade, the entire country of Brazil was on the edge of collapse. In fact, there's a great documentary called The Edge of Democracy, because what happened in Brazil was there was a scheme that was uncovered whereby about a third of their congressmen and two of the presidents were systematically looting Petrobras. Every contract had a 5% kickback for these elite political leaders, and it was uncovered, but the country almost collapsed. And so that's your second and third largest holding, the corrupt state-owned oil company. But you don't own the internet. Imagine if the S&P 500 owned, we don't really have any state-owned oil companies, but Amtrak or great, some of these, and it didn't own Amazon. And that's basically what the emerging market index doesn't own the Amazon or Netflix or whatever other app you can think of that's the emerging market version.
Yeah, that's insane. So you got pretty much the worst possible companies you could have on there and not the best ones you can have.
It's a,
Yeah.
yeah, so that's my why, I guess. I'm trying
It's
to
not even
fix
really sugarcoating it there.
it's an issue.
So Kevin, I want to transition this to something now that I call the final round, because you gave us so much awesomeness with all of that. Normally I'll chime in a lot more, but I just kept listening because I was just so fascinated with what you were sharing. To summarize what you have done from the beginning to now with emerging markets, is there anything else you want to add to that before we go into the final round? Because it's been a very interesting topic.
Sure.
I want to ask you, is there a specific emerging market right now that you're focused on?
Sure. Let me first explain what I do and what my company does. So my company is called EMQQ Global. And our flagship ETF has the ticker EMQQ. So that's an emerging markets internet fund. If you just want to invest in the Mercado Libres and the internet companies in the emerging markets, EMQQ is the ticker. It's about 9.5 years old. We have an ex-China version, which is called FMQQ, F as in frontier. And as you likely know very well, there's a lot of tensions in the world, and in particular, non-military conflict between the United States and China. And a lot of people are afraid of China. I think most of the things people believe are wrong about China, but I can't control what people think. But the other thing is, China's e-commerce market's the most developed on the planet. China might be an emerging market, but in the digital sense, no, its e-commerce market is 4 times as big as ours, and it's 4 times as big as every other emerging market combined. So really, the next phase of the growth is going to be outside of China, and FMQQ. If you don't want China or you want the next 20-year story, then that's FMQQ. And then we have an India-only strategy, which is INQQ. And that's the one that we're focused on the most right now. India is the perfect emerging market, I think. And it really has everything going for it. It's a lot like China 20 years ago, but it's a democracy, which is favorable to most people. But perhaps more importantly, when China started entering this growth phase, nobody on the planet had a smartphone. And so ultimately, what all of our strategies are about is there's 3 mega trends happening. All those billions of consumers I already mentioned, they're happening, but they're also getting their first ever computer today. So I had a computer for 20 years before I got the smartphone 10 years ago.
Is that the original iPhone you just held up?
It is.
Yeah, I would say that looks like the original.
So wow. 10 years ago, I got a call from my friend, and this was sitting on my car seat. I answered the phone, and my friend said, "What's the best emerging markets ETF for my 3-year-old daughter?" And I started to say, "Buy the emerging market consumer index or ETF." But then I was like, wait a minute, that's not the answer, because now the best consumer companies, the database says they're technology companies. And so I could see that the Mercado Libre was not it wasn't in the big index. It also wasn't in the consumer index, because the database didn't say it was a consumer stock. The database said it was a technology stock. But it's billions of people getting their first ever computer and the internet for the first time. I got the internet in 1995. Nobody else has been wired. In India right now, 7 million people a month are getting this. Not this, not an Apple involved, but you can buy a brand new Android-based smartphone today for $12 in India. I was going to say 15, but it's literally 12. As of July 3rd, the Jio Bharat pocket-sized supercomputer. So India's got, it's happening, but it's also happening when pocket-sized supercomputer and wireless internet are ubiquitous. The India story is incredibly compelling, and they've also built this platform for the economy, which is a digital ID system that's allowed them to open 800 million digital bank accounts just using their fingerprints and eyeball skin. So they've taken all these people from the informal economy, not in the banking system, and used this homemade database to give them access to banking. And they've also signed up 500 million smartphone subscribers using. It used to take 3 hours to get a smartphone, but using their countrywide biometric database, they cut that down to 10 minutes. So in a matter of years, you've taken the entire thing and built this digital platform and digital inclusion where every single person is in, and they have an instant free payments layer as well on top of all that has exploded. It's a half of the entire world's digital real-time payments are in India. And this has just happened in the last 7 years. And the Indian economy was 95% paper-based 7 years ago, right? Currency, paper money. Today, it's 80% digital.
Wow.
And so anyhow, the India story is incredibly compelling. So I make sure people understand, like, if you want to invest in these versions of emerging markets, that's the way to do it. EMQQ, awesome. FMQQ, INQQ.
All right. I definitely appreciate that. Okay. So, Kevin, going into the final round, I'm going to
Yes.
ask you the same four questions I ask everybody that comes on the show. It gives us a good idea of how you are under a little bit of pressure, which I already know you're going to be just fine. So if you're ready to go, we'll get that party started.
I'm ready.
All right, Kevin. So what is the biggest mistake you've ever made when it comes to your finance or business life?
I think that probably one of the bigger mistakes that I've made was not having an income for several years. As an entrepreneur, you get paid in pops. And so I would make money on the thing we sold, the E-Trade, and then I wouldn't have any income for a couple of years. So that miracle of compounding, if you're using your savings to live off of, if I had maintained a stable income, there were probably 10 or 15 of the last 20 years, I didn't have positive cash flow. I've managed to pick some pretty good stocks, but a lot of times along the way, I'd have to liquidate them early to pay for a new idea that I was going to build or what have you. So the miracle of compounding is everything. And so you want to get cash flow positive and stay there your whole life. Again, as an entrepreneur, that becomes challenging if you move on from one thing to the next, but start early, buy and hold. And again, the miracle of compounding is so important in this.
All right. Awesome. Appreciate that. Okay, Kevin.
Yeah. Oh, by the way,
speaking of compounding, wonder of the world. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I should also mention, I also shorted Amazon.com in 1998 and told other people they should do the same thing as well. I shorted $50,000 worth of Amazon, which was basically all the money I think I had at that point. And I lost a third of it in a day. If I had just bought and hold that Amazon, it would be worth $50 billion.
Yeah.
So that's probably my biggest mistake now that I think about it. But
gotcha. Yeah, that's rough to, and a lot of, I think a lot of people can relate to that. Maybe not so much that amount, but there was a time I bought this one stock and it was a penny stock and it doubled in value and I sold it because I was super excited. And then they acquired three other companies and it like 50x'd. And I'm like, really? So I was pretty upset. I should have just sold what I put into it and just kept the rest in, like my profits. But nope, I didn't do that. I just sold it all.
Yes. Okay. Now you're reminding me of my other biggest mistake. I bought Tesla stock about 10 years ago or 11 years ago, and I sold it 9 years ago.
Oh, no.
I made a lot of money, but I don't know. I think I tripled my money, but it was another one where I did miracle of compounding.
Yep. Okay.
I didn't right let on. That accumulate like it could have.
Yeah. Still, you still did really well, but yeah.
I'm not complaining.
Yep. All right, Kevin, next question of the final round, you'll see that these kind of feed into each other. What is something that you've learned that you wish you knew when you first started out?
I guess the same thing. I've learned that it's long term and you got to think long term and be long term. And you get up, and I know that I think about this from Mercado Libre. I happened to be with a bunch of my college friends 10 years ago for a trip, and one of them asked me about stocks, and I told them Mercado Libre. And I didn't realize this, but he went back and called his advisor and bought some of that and held it. And again, I had some of it, but he made a pretty big bet. And so the miracle of compounding, I just think it's so important. And because when you buy a stock at 50 and the stock gets to 1,000, or, and that's obviously people would love that, but let's say it gets to 500. Then if it goes up 10%, that's 100% return for you on your, right? On your, so this is why that miracle of compounding is so important. So I wish I appreciated it more earlier. Yeah, I think that's, I hope that's different than my first answer, but they're in the same family.
Yeah, no, it is. It is in the same family. And a lot of times when I get answers to those questions, they do sometimes come to that crossroads with each other, right? Because they're very similar things, because a lot of times you think back to your mistake and you're like, man, if I would have known this, I might not have made that mistake. And again, your big one was not thinking about the compounding, right?
Yeah, I guess that
it fits.
Yeah.
Okay, Kevin. So the next question is, do you have any tips or tricks that you would recommend to someone that is just getting started today?
Read. Read A Random Walk Down Wall Street. Read
Oh no, don't
Peter
even
Lynch.
tell me that, because the next question I have for you, see,
Yes.
that's a great
I
tip. So
just study,
yeah.
learn. And
Awesome.
everything's out there. Everything that needs to be known about investing in the stock market. Again, this is my focus. There's nothing new to be learned. This is all essentially figured out. And it's all really simple mathematics. That's one of the beauty of investing, as Warren Buffett points out very frequently, is you don't need Greek symbols or this is really just a lot of common sense basic stuff with a little bit of high school algebra.
Yeah, no, it is. It's high school math, honestly. Okay, you were going into it, so I'm going to ask you the last question here, and that is, do you have a favorite business, investing, or real estate related book or podcast or both?
Sure. I would say, of course, I've mentioned a book that was the most important in my journey. So that one's been mentioned. Berkshire Hathaway Annual Reports, the book Snowball. Warren Buffett hasn't written a autobiography, but there's lots of people who have written about him. The Warren Buffett Way, another one. There's a Charlie Munger book called Damn that would be on my list. And then not directly investment related, I think one of the greatest books I read about business is The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing, which one of my mentors gave me 30 years ago. And it's a really simple book. You can read it in an hour probably. And it's really good in thinking about, especially for entrepreneurial, or you're trying to build a business, how to think about marketing. I still give that book to people and refer to it. And it's 22 chapters for each of the laws, and they're each 4 or 5 pages, so it's easy to digest. And then one of the books that comes to mind is a book called Tell to Win, which was written by the owners of the Golden State Warriors, who is also the Mandalay Bay Entertainment and Casinos. I'm trying to remember his name, but it's called Tell to Win, and it speaks to the importance of telling stories in the business context and not going so much into numbers and charts and graphs, but the importance of connecting people by painting them a picture, telling them a story, which I've found instructive and helpful in
Yeah,
development.
that's a lot of times that's how you'll connect with somebody, right? That's how you'll actually grab their attention. It's not going to be the numbers and the data. It's going to be how you present it,
That's
which is
right. And
why
then
I love podcasting and why I love doing what I'm doing here is I get to share people's stories and you get to present what it is that you're doing. And somebody might be listening right now and say, "Hey, man, oh, that is really interesting. I want to learn more about that." And actually, so that's it for the final round, but I do have another question I want to ask you. So this is like the perfect segue into that. And that's going to be so, Kevin, where can people find more information about you? Do you have a website you could share with us? Any social media profiles we could follow,
sure.
especially for the folks that might want to get involved in emerging markets?
Sure. LinkedIn is the best place to find me on social media, and Kevin T. Carter, and put my name and EMQQ. I'm sure that'll pop up and you can find me. And then our website is EMQ, again, E as in emerging, M as in market, EMQLOBAL.com. So that's where you can find our website.
Awesome. So I will make sure I have those links in the show notes for all my listeners. The deal, don't try to open them if you're driving right now. Wait till you're in a safe place, but they'll be there for you to copy and paste or click away. Kevin, thank you so much for taking your time out today to share some amazing information with us and share your story. It was really awesome, and I'm glad to know you now, and I really hope we could stay in touch.
Oh, good. You're super sweet. Yes, I try to get to Oahu as frequently as I can. So I'll
Hit me up next
find you.
time you're out here for
I will
sure.
do. All right, Mike. Thank you.
Awesome. Hey, I also want to thank all of my listeners. I want to thank all of you so much for joining me and our special guest, Kevin Carter, on the Average Joe Finances podcast. Go leave us a 5-star review and tell us what you liked about today's episode with Kevin. Aloha from Hawaii and have a great rest of your day. Thank you for making it to the end of this episode. Greatly appreciate you being here with me today on the Average Joe Finances podcast. If you haven't done so yet, make this the episode that you go leave us a 5-star rating or subscribe to our YouTube channel. The Average Joe Finances podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Have an outstanding day.
Thanks for listening to the Average Joe Finances podcast, your source for beating debt, saving money, and investing. Learn more at averagejoefinances.com.